Yeah, good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. And today joining me is special guest, Chris Rule. He's a technology director. For the last 25 years, across a wide variety of school districts that K-12, and they're in the small and rural school districts. However, these techniques and challenges are also applicable to larger schools. And he's going to talk to us today about these technology challenges. And Chris was just bringing up this whole point with me about how cybersecurity has been a hot topic for the last decade in schools. And I don't believe you. No, you know, you said the needle hasn't moved. And I agree. I totally agree. And you know, when you say it's a hot topic, I don't believe you because I haven't seen the needle move.
schools, we do a lot of talking. A lot of talking, not necessarily a lot of doing. So, but thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I wonder if you would, when you talk about these things, if you would kind of infuse concepts of operational maturity in there, because I sense that what you're going to tell us about the challenges as to why that needle hasn't moved has a lot to do with operational maturity practices, such as, like, you know, third-party information security, mm-hmm. risk management, vendor risk management, vulnerability management, password management.
Oh, it's all of that. Yeah. And yeah, so what we were talking about before we came on is there are surveys that show that cybersecurity has been the number one topic for the past 10 years.
Do you know who they're surveying when they do that?
It's tech directors. So this is a survey that's done annually by COSIN, which is the Consortium for School Networks, which is a professional organization specifically for K-12 technology directors. And they've been around for more than 30 years, and they offer resources like this yearly, like survey to see what the hot topics are in schools. And cybersecurity has been the number one from all the tech directors that responded.
Who's the audience of the survey? Like, does it help you as a technology director, or is it intended for somebody else?
No, it's intended for education. They try to put the data together in a format that would be applicable to help technology directors talk to the board about things that they may need.
Yeah.
So they really try to do it at that executive level.
So it's less, this is what Chris says, and more like, this is what the entire industry is saying.
Correct. Yes, yeah. Correct. Okay. Yeah. Good. So you can't disseminate the data and say, look, in Virginia, they said the top, topic is this. It's more like across the nation, these are the things that schools are trying to prioritize. Mm-hmm. Okay. And cybersecurity has been on the top of that list for a long time. And it really is listed as cybersecurity, not information security. Now,
do you think that has any correlation with, like, insurance requirements?
I think that is definitely has kicked it up in the past few years, because while most schools don't have to have cyber insurance, a lot of schools, it's kind of bundled in their package. Like they almost have to have it. And so that has definitely brought it to light, because, you know, just like we were saying before, these maturity models, schools don't really have a compliance that they have to meet, right? And so this insurance requirement almost became a non-standard compliance. Like, you have to have MFA if you want this insurance. And so then schools had to scramble to figure out how to even become mature enough to get cyber insurance.
You know, the sad thing about what you said is that from my perspective, I've always thought that schools had compliance. They are loaded with personally identifiable information, mm-hmm. which puts them mm-hmm. under, you know, FTC regs. They also, I thought it was the Child Internet Protection Act at a minimum that they had to comply with.
So there's that you don't actually don't have to even meet SEPA compliance. So there is a SEPA compliance level, but that the only thing that you get by meeting SEPA compliance is that you can then qualify for E-rate, which is a discount on your internet connection, is essentially what it is.
Oh, sure. But everybody is using that. You know, every school is using that. So that is that inherently what you're saying is now they need to be SEPA compliant.
Mm-hmm. But SEPA compliance is super easy. It's just simply, we're going to have a filtering solution in place that will protect our kids from the bad stuff. That's pretty much as loose as it is, right? So we put a filter in place that monitors internet traffic and it blocks, you know, malware and some malicious things, but mostly it blocks, you know, the real bad stuff on the internet, violence and porn. And
okay, so that's where I was like, where, like, how do you take SEPA and turn it into an organizational acceptable use policy? Because I have yet to actually see a school do that. There seems to be a very severe disconnect between what SEPA, just kind of like, I'm going to call it common sense best practices about like bad stuff, as you articulated, versus nobody really at the management level wants to be inconvenienced.
That's very true.
So how do you, you know, how do you make that leap then, especially with schools that don't have the time for it and probably lack the operational maturity to get there?
Well, there's probably three things that are the closest to compliance. One would be SEPA, which is a compliance in order to receive some federal funding. Then you have FERPA, which is the like a Child Data Privacy Act.
Right.
And then you have COPA, which is COPA is to protect kids under age 13. And all of those kind of get taken into consideration when you're creating policies for a school. Usually those policies in a school boil down to how much permission do we have to have from parents in order to provide our kids with the tools that we want to use. And schools rarely, even though COPA was designed to protect kids that are young, schools rarely even think about what's happening with that data when they give it to a third party.
Right.
You know, they might think about, well, we have kids and, you know, they're more concerned about kids are going to be turning age 13 sometime in middle school. So how do we put an internet policy in place that can let an eighth grader that may have started the year at 12 years old, that's now turning 13? What do we do for that individual? I mean, those are the things that schools are thinking about. They're not thinking about, okay, we're handing over all this information to XYZ application for all of our rostering data, and we've not even vetted that vendor to find out, you know, what they're doing.
Well, okay, I have to pivot off of that because that's a fantastic point, and it isn't just about the third party information security risk management and that vendor risk management, which absolutely needs to be done. And frankly, most large companies don't do that well. But the other piece is, I still, even in large organizations, not just in schools, but even in large organizations, I run into this thing where they're like, well, the data's in Salesforce, so therefore it's secure. And it's like, no, that doesn't inherently make it secure. I'm like, okay, so really, when I'm looking at like a cyber insurance questionnaire, or I'm looking at a vendor risk assessment that one of my clients is going through for one of their customers, these sorts of questions come up, which is like, what about your employee onboarding policy, right? How are you ensuring that your staff are trained with regards to this private data handling? So this whole concept that says that it's in some sort of a secure, and I'm air quoting, secure SaaS platform, that doesn't address any of the needs of, I have a computing platform that I have relative assurance is not compromised, and therefore the data is getting stolen that way, but also that I have trained my people so that they're doing secure processes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do we deal with people, and how do you deal with in the education space, trying to get the right people to make those policies to actually address, really, I'm going to call it the three legs of the stool. One is we do have to know what the vendors are doing, but we have to be training our people properly, and we have to secure the endpoints that they're accessing that data properly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we're seeing a trend in education, kind of a shift in the attack vector, definitely toward social engineering. Because while we say the needle hasn't moved, there have been more technical solutions that have been applied at schools. Schools know they need to do something. So they're, and usually it's coming from an insurance compliance, right? They need to implement MFA. They have to have endpoint detection and response. You know, these things that they may have never even thought about before. Suddenly they are becoming a little more hardened. And so now the attack vector has shifted to social engineering, and it is attacking that the weakest point, right? The people. And so, you know, a lot of schools we use Know Before. There are different platforms that aren't just phishing awareness, but that will do some sort of training. And I would say probably good cyber insurance programs will require that, and some even offer it.
But
I've seen, it's not very good.
Well, so we have an excellent cyber awareness training platform. However, as a CISO, I and my SOWs to clients say, you need to change these HR policies. You mm-hmm. need to change these onboarding policies. You need to change the culture of your company to make it mm-hmm. completely not only acceptable to do training, but mandatory to do training.
Right.
So it's like, I feel like that's the big piece that's missing in the vast majority of the time, is that the technical controls are really kind of a minority of the solution. And it's like 80% of it is HR management.
It is. Well, and it's like you said, it's a culture thing. It's an awareness thing. And it's a prioritizing that, because if the board and your main leadership team, your cabinet, whatever you want to call that in a school district, if they're not bought into the concept that cybersecurity or information security is not just IT, mm-hmm. then you're not going to, as we said, move that needle.
You're not going anywhere. Because, oh my gosh, yeah, you just hit on one of my hot buttons of all time. I call it the grenade over the wall. It's like, oh, we'll send it, shoot it over to IT.
Yeah, they'll take care of it. Well, I see it all the time. So recently we put in a emergency response solution, which is basically a tool that everybody has on their phone that if you have a lockdown, it alerts, or if you're doing a drill, it'll alert that. And suddenly that became an IT thing, because IT handles incidents. Well, you know, not a fire or an earthquake or an active shooter is not an IT incident. And even if it were, it still involves everybody. And so
I'm sorry, that's just all the time.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Why am I setting up fire drills now all of a sudden?
No, you know what? If IT is in charge of active shooter, I totally got a solution to that problem. It's called the Terminator. I got robots
perfect.
For that problem.
AI, yes.
And most of the time I actually would prefer it if they would just say, yes, you know what? You, IT, you are the resource owner. Because if they would just make me the resource owner, oh, I would write the policy. You know
what
I mean?
Well, and that's the problem too, is right. It is a flip side of the coin, because they're like, oh, yep, it's an IT thing. Here, you do it. But then when we try to do it,
you have no authority to do it.
Right. Yeah, there's no authority, right? Even if we write a policy, I have board members right now that they won't use a district provided email. They want to use either a work email or a home email, which is kind of a legal nightmare anyway, because if there's a FOIA request, they're opening up their own private data right there, and we can't
exactly
get
right.
to see it.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, that's one of those things where it's like, a lot of times I get behavioral change by articulating how it's going to benefit them. Like, no, you don't want that nightmare in your personal
right.
bucket.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. But sometimes they still don't see it. Schools are very unique in that they're ran by the school board. Oftentimes those are not educated people, for one, not educated as much as their staff is anyway. They have varying roles within the community. Oftentimes they're being a board member just because they have an agenda. They want to, you know, so I have a problem with the dress code, or that's why they decided to be a board member. So you suddenly have this group of very diverse individuals running your school with strong opinions that maybe don't even align to what your school culture is.
Are are these mostly volunteer positions as well?
Mm-hmm. Almost always. I think some school board positions are paid, and in maybe some of the larger districts, but in smaller districts, and I think 85% of the school districts in the country are 2,500 students or less. So the majority of the school districts are small, but the majority of students are in, of course, the larger school districts. But yeah, in those small school districts, the board is just a volunteer position.
Well, it's got to be difficult to get them to make time to elevate their own knowledge to the point where they can be an informed risk decision maker when it's volunteer time.
It is. Yeah. And they have other things going on. And so for as a tech director to try to get some time during the board meeting, if you get 5 minutes during the board meeting, that's not enough time to convey a solid message of, you know, even awareness of a training program. It is a unique challenge.
Have you ever tried a curricula for new board members and had that as a as an instituted policy? Because this isn't just a technology thing, right? This is about the legal things that board members need to know. And there,
yes.
It would seem to me there would need to be a specific onboarding program just for directors.
There should be. But, I mean, there's no official onboarding program even for a teacher, right? And it varies from district to district. And so it does become tough. There, you know, the board has professional organizations that they go to that you know, that's what they try to do. They try to educate the board of what their job is. They're not there to micromanage. They're there to govern, to oversee, and, you know, to manage. And you will get board members that definitely improve. You know, if you have a board member that's been on your board for 15, 20 years, they're far more educated and experienced, of course, than the younger ones. I think there needs to be more collaboration with that board professional organization and with security companies to find out what that need is to try to raise that awareness. And it's, we keep saying the needle's not moving. It is slowly moving. There's becoming more awareness, and it is slowly changing, but it's partly driven by the events that are happening. You know, the schools are getting hit with ransomware, and everyone knows of school that's fairly close that's been hit by something. And unfortunately, schools are more likely to react than to be proactive. But when it happens to someone that you know, or someone you know who you know through someone else, it becomes a little bit more personal, and that helps.
I feel like there's an aspect of this that needs to be on the demand side as well. Like, let me tell you what I mean by that. I'm always a big proponent of, you know, free choice and fixing issues on the demand side, right? So like, if I'm a parent and I have my three kids and I want to decide what school I'm going to put them in, one of the factors that I should be evaluating is, how well is that school going to protect my child's information?
Absolutely.
And I feel like there's no mechanism for them to do that at this point in time. And I don't have a lot of warm fuzzies. I don't even have 50% warm fuzzies about most of the schools that are out there. And I'm not picking on schools. It's just, I would also make that statement about most of the businesses that are out there.
Sure.
And so I think it's not necessarily exclusively, you know, an education problem. I mean, I did a couple podcasts on the topic of how most people who are getting their taxes prepared are not actually doing an appropriate vetting of their selected tax preparer. And so it's like a lot of these things I feel like need to be fixed on the demand side. So if you're a parent, I don't think there's any resources right now that you could go to get that sort of evaluation criteria. Are you aware of any?
There's not from that standpoint. I mean, you've got good schools and different things where people will go out and put, it's kind of like Yelp for schools, right? That's, they'll go out and put just a general review. There's nothing for data privacy and security. There is, COSIN put out a TLE certification, which is a voluntary program that schools can go through. That's the Trusted Learning Environment. And in order to meet that, it's a several year process of going through and meeting kind of like a certification level that just says, yes, we're dedicated to protecting student data. And these are the hoops that we had to jump through to do it, more or less.
Does it help a school become more competitive? I mean, like, what's their incentive for doing that?
I guess the incentive is to build community trust. I think it's two things. It would be to build community trust because, I mean, you want to have trust from your parents and your community, but it's also they're going to improve along the way. So if you have a pretty insightful, you know, technology director, or maybe they're fortunate enough to have a CISO on staff, if they go through that process without having to hire a third-party consultant, they can go through and use this light framework and come up with some controls and put measures in place to improve.
What kind of overlap is there between that and something like CIS?
There's definitely overlap, right? The most of the control systems, as you know, have overlap. I think it's built partly with CIS, the 18 controls, and then some NIST framework. We're seeing we talked before, there's no compliance level at schools, but I think it's coming. I think from the federal level, within the next 5 years, we'll probably be seeing something, EduRamp or something, that'll be a compliance level for schools, because when schools get hit with ransomware, the money's got to come from somewhere, and it's all government funding, whether it's state or federal. And I think with the attention that schools are getting and the money that's being lost and the education that's being interrupted, I think we're going to see something, and I don't know what that'll look like. And there are third-party companies and organizations that are putting things together to try to help schools. There was recently a consortium of security companies that put together a cybersecurity rubric, trying to focus it primarily on education. They looked at a number of different control systems from NIST and CIS. They even looked at Security Studio's platform and some different ones to try to crosswalk and figure out what was going to be the best platform or the best controls to do that. And so they kind of settled on something that's very similar to NIST, almost kind of designed their own NIST EDU framework, and they even updated it for the new 2.0. It's free to schools, and so that's, I think, has helped. But the problem is that, I mean, there are resources out there. You know, CIS has all these tons of resources, and it's a great platform for schools. But most schools don't have the time, you know, or the education to do it, you know, or the focus, yeah. I guess, would be what we should say, the priority.
I think the core issue that I see is that they, and this I'll put schools in the same bucket with a bunch of businesses that I know of as well. They think that the IT director has time to do that stuff, as well as somehow has the power and authority to do that stuff.
Right.
And I don't. I've never seen it. Mm-hmm. Instead, the only time I've seen those efforts really be successful, I mean, certainly, yes, there are going to be edge cases, but the times that I've seen those efforts be really successful is when there is at least a fractional CTO or a fractional CISO involved, but on an engagement. You know, like on an ongoing engagement. So there's like this kind of long-term relationship, because I feel like it's just asking too much of an IT director to be like, well, manage the whole budget, manage the technology, respond to support tickets, do all this, manage the staff and blah, blah, blah. And then somehow you're supposed to manufacture some more time. And I mean, you're very different than most IT directors. I mean, most IT directors do not have your level of skill with regards to compliance and you know, on the CISO side, in my opinion. And so most IT directors, I think, they struggle with even articulating the value proposition of why these other efforts actually need to happen. And so without that kind of executive level initiative being pushed, then there is no one at the executive level pushing it. And to your point, the priorities always get overridden.
Right. Right. Yeah. We're so, I hate to say the word underfunded, but the reality is that if you work in technology and education, you can probably go into the public sector and make twice as much just by changing jobs. So most people who work in education, especially in technology, they do it because they have kids in school, or they're doing it because they get great benefits, or maybe they get the summer off. There's some other thing other than the financial that's keeping them there. So that tends to not bring out the best talent for an education environment. And some of that,
but that's part of why having a fractional CTO or a fractional CISO involved is
well, and
beneficial.
You know, the other thing too is that cultures in school kind of, if someone's an outside expert, they're almost valued better than an inside expert. You could have someone in a school that's super qualified, and when they make a recommendation, for some reason, when you hire a consultant, the consultant may not have even as much experience as someone in-house, but that opinion is regarded higher. And so you're right. When you bring in someone like a fractional CISO, or even just someone who's going to maybe do a one-time risk assessment, it's taken with more authority than your in-house staff, which is unfortunate.
I know you've seen that, and I definitely understand that, you know, that paradigm. I've seen it in some organizations as well. I do see, though, there appears to be this sort of like budgetary pressure that just changes people's mindset. Instead of thinking about how do we get a relationship with a fractional CISO for, let's just say, I don't know, $26,000 a year. Okay. So instead of coming
up 24, with the math would be easier.
Well, okay. but you get what I'm saying? Like it's a paradigm change of saying, let's at least do something. Mm-hmm. On a regular, ongoing basis, as part of this relationship, as opposed to, no, we can't do anything because it costs too much money. It's like, well, mm-hmm. No, you know what's really going to cost too much money is when you didn't plan properly.
Yes.
And
yeah,
and
when you succumb to that ransomware event, that's going to be expensive. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the paradigm problem that I see most of the time, and this isn't just education, it's that they really have this sort of like budget block mindset, and they're not even willing to allocate fairly minor amounts of money to the problem. Mm. And so then they just pile it on to the IT director. And I've seen this so many times. You know, it's like, well, the IT director works for us full time. We'll just ask the IT director.
She's already working for us. Yeah.
Yeah. Just keep piling on. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes a matter of too many priorities, always constantly competing priorities. And this is exactly, it's not just an IT director problem, but I see that problem itself is exactly why a lot of internal IT departments don't get their systems patched, and that maintenance isn't done, or lifecycle asset management isn't done, because really it's only the IT people that care about that stuff.
Right. Absolutely. It only is. And a lot of times we don't care. No, I was thinking.
Well, it's hard, you know, it's hard to care, right? It's hard to prioritize that.
I mean, there are some days you just walk home. You just go home and you're like, I can't do anymore. I'm, you know, all this stuff needs to be done, but I'm done for the day.
Well, not only that, but, you know, it's smart to walk away sometimes, because you know that if you go open that can of worms at 6 p.m., you don't have enough time or energy, and maybe the right people at that particular change window to be able to do a recovery if poo-poo goes the wrong way.
Right. Yep.
You know, so I would call it adult to go home and go to bed. I'll wrap it up with a real quick story here. Many, many, many years ago, I worked with this gentleman who was, at the time, he was in his 60s. And I mean, he would come to work at like 5 a.m., you know, some ridiculously early hour. And you know, going out the door one day, he says to me, oh, yeah, I'm going to go home and I'll work on the thing. And I said, no, dude, nothing good happens after 6 p.m. Please do not go home and work on the server from home. Please do not. And he made a mistake in some scripting, and he basically blew up the home drives for like 13,000 users, you know. So it was like super bad. Okay, well, we're over for today. So thank you much for your time.
Thanks for having me.